This is file 9, cycle 2. This is Gene McMillan. I am going to interview George Kiefer for his 4th oral history, but the first with me. He's going to talk about his family background, his businesses, anything else he wants to talk about, and we're just going to have a good time.
Going now?
It's going now. What's your name?
What's my name?
Yes, sir?
George Kiefer, K-I-E-F-E-R.
And what's your middle name?
Crony.
How do you spell that?
C-R-O-N-E-Y.
Matthew was right. Your birth date?
Matthew was Matthias.
Yeah, Matthias.
December 15th, 1921.
Where were you born?
Hamden, Connecticut. At home.
Oh, good for you. Your parents' names?
George C. Kiefer. I'm a junior.
Yes.
And Hazel Nesbitt Kiefer, N-E-S-B-I-T.
Thank you for the spelling. Did you have brothers or sisters?
I have a sister who's 7 years older than I, and her name is Jean.
J-E-A-N?
J-E-A-N.
Love the name.
Don't find it very often.
No. They gussy it up with a couple of extra letters.
Yeah.
Where did you go to school after high school?
Well, my high school, I was at Salisbury School here from 1936 to 1940 when I graduated.
Okay.
Then I went to Duke University to study forestry. And World War II came along and I enlisted in the Navy. And served in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, I went back to college on the GI Bill and finished my education.
I think I know the answer to this, but you first came to the area to go to Salisbury School?
Yeah.
Tell me about what you remember about Salisbury School when you were a student.
When I was a student, my first year there, which was in the fall of 1936, there were 32 boys in the school. Not in my class, but the entire school.
Mm-hmm.
And the school was going through hard times, and the founder of it was Mr. George Emerson Quayle. He brought it up from Staten Island, I believe.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
It was St. Austin's.
Yeah. And toward the end, the Depression came along, and his health got weaker and so on, and the enrollment dropped right down. The year before I got there, there were only 28 students. But previous to that, I don't know whether it must have been 75 or 80 when it was a full complement, based on the number of buildings that were there. And then Emerson Quayle, his son, who was teaching at Hotchkiss School, took over Salisbury School.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was headmaster for the 4 years that I was there. And when I graduated, there were 60 students in the school.
Good.
13 in my class.
What extracurricular activities did you participate in at Salisbury?
Well, I did football for a couple of years, and then I had something went crazy with my kidney or something. I didn't do any more of that. So I skied and mostly rowing,
mm-hmm.
crew.
You have
and a little bit of hockey.
You have a son that's an Olympic.
Yeah.
Tom. He's the one I had in school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And Matt was a heck of a good rower. They both went to Salisbury.
Yeah.
They were both excellent rowers there.
Matt showed me pictures of you at Salisbury and their succeeding generations.
Oh, really?
Are there any other connections with Salisbury School other than your attending there?
Well, the only connection is that I married Mary Louise Coyle, who was Emerson Coyle's daughter, and she's the mother of my kids.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Now, when you actually came to Salisbury to live, did you buy a house or did you rent a house with your Uncle Joe?
When I first went to work for Shiles.
In Norfolk?
In Norfolk. In 1948. And I rented a room in the house that we're sitting in now on Selleck Hill. Miss Leslie Emmett owns the house, and my folks knew it, had connections up here with many, many friends in Salisbury well before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And Leslie had a room upstairs, and I rented here.
Yeah.
And then eventually, when Mary Louise and I got married, that was a couple of years later, I lived on Canaan Mountain in a house that belonged to the Great Mountain Forest, which was Childs' enterprise. And we left there. I decided after 4 years working for Childs, which I enjoyed the work and liked to work with him, and he's a good guy to work with and for, decided I just wanted to work for myself if I could, or give it a go as a forester. So we moved down and spent the winter at my mother-in-law, Mrs. Quayle's house, and then Uncle Joe, her uncle, my wife's great-uncle, had land across from Indian Mountain School, Joe Parsons, and he had a little shanty out in the field that had, I was up on stilts, and it was just for summer help to live there when he had a farm and orchard and whatever he had over there. But we lived in that for a couple of years. I could do some work on it to do a little insulating and put some aluminum around the base of it because it sat up on pilings so the pipes wouldn't freeze, and put a floor furnace in the little house, and that heated us, and we were there for two or three years. And then in 1955, this house came up for sale, and here we are.
Full circle.
Full circle, yeah.
Now, how much land did Uncle Joe Parsons own? Do you remember?
Gosh, I don't know, a lot, though. Yeah.
It was a big spot.
It had been somebody, Clark, owned the farm. But it went almost all the way down close to, I think Camp Sloan came out of that farm.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
So he had from the road there, Long Pond Road, all the way down and down to Long Pond itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had one big field on the opposite side of the road, abutting what was the Cedars Country Club.
Oh, the Cedars.
Not the Cedars, but what abutted their golf course, which was also on.
Okay. What did Joe Parsons look like?
Nice old guy.
Like you, okay.
Shorter than I, maybe, I guess, but he was active, and when I lived there and I was self-employed, I had a room upstairs in the barn, which is my office, so-called, and I can remember in the spring and summer, when grass was growing, Uncle Joe would come out and swing a scythe for cutting.
Oh, that's work.
Yeah.
I've done that. That's work.
If it's a sharp scythe, it's not that much work.
No, but you have to know how to sharpen it.
Yes, you do. You have to know, and not fight it.
Yep.
Yeah.
How about Rose Parsons? What did she look like?
Great Aunt Rose is just nice.
Nice old lady.
Very nice lady, with a good sense of humor.
She started some organization in town, didn't she?
nurses.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that started about 1904?
Thereabouts, more or less. Lee knows better than I.
Not necessarily, but I've read a lot. You already answered the next question that I had. This house has... When do you know when this house was built?
Best I can tell, I'm doing research. A man bought this property in 1756. 4 years later, he sold the property with house, orcharding, fencing, and improvements. 32 acres.
My word. Have you added any rooms to the house, or is it the same footprint?
I have not messed with it at all.
You have? Oh, good for you.
No.
Good for you.
No. I've improved the inside a little bit here in the kitchen, but other than that...
Well, it's better not to. It's better not to.
I had to put a new chimney in, because the chimney that... As you see here, the chimney comes right down into the basement here.
Mm-hmm.
But under the basement where we are sitting here now in the kitchen, it was just not even crawl space.
Ooh.
And so this kitchen room was added on to the original house, because the next room in has a big fireplace and a Dutch oven in that chimney.
Oh, wonderful.
And the chimney that was out here on the addition, the chimney stopped at the floor upstairs.
Ah.
And then you had a stove down here, and you had to run it through and up through a thimble and so on and into the chimney up there. And when we went to clean the chimney, I'd always been told that old timers used to take a cedar tree and push it down and so on. And I dropped the rope down, and Wheezy was on the other end of the rope where the opening was in the furnace, in the chimney. And she said, okay, I'll tie the cedar tree on. I said, pull her down, and I'll pull her back up again. We'll get her cleaned out. She started to pull, and as she pulled, the chimney bricks started falling off the chimney. So I said, stop, we better not do any more of this. So we thought we'd better get a safer chimney in here.
Makes sense, yeah. Makes sense. But they were using the cedar tree as a brush.
As a brush, yeah.
To get the creosote off.
Yeah.
Oh, that's clever. I never heard of that one.
Well, you're not old enough.
Oh, but I will be.
Yeah. You heard it in your youth.
Oh, goodness. Why did you start a Christmas tree farm?
Well, let's see. Why did I start here? First of all, I was doing... Christmas trees got to be a sort of... talking point for a lot of people thinking they can make quick money with their land and so on and grow Christmas trees. And as a forester, I did some research on that and began just helping them. I'd order trees for them, plant trees, shear the trees, mow the trees, help sell the trees for wholesale and so on for various clients. And so then that's about when I did a lot of that in November and December, and planting in the springtime, and shearing and shaping the trees in the summertime, and got involved quite a lot in that with several clients. So I was spread by the time harvesting time, when the trees had, after 7, 8, or 9 years, got big enough to sell, then I was made contacts with chambers of commerce or guys who had nurseries that wanted to sell trees as part of their income. I would be busy with selling them in the fall and supervising the cutting and so forth and running around like a nut from one plantation to the next. So.
Did you ever help the West Smiths down in Sharon?
Yes, I did indeed.
Okay.
There's a story that goes with that also, because I was in partnership with a man, he and I, who owned the property then, Ted Church, he's a lawyer, and a man I'd known as a youngster when I went to a summer camp as a kid up in New Hampshire. Anyhow, when he was, he first, somehow we were in contact, and he knows I was here. And he was a counselor when I was a kid in this camp. And I was talking with him, and he said, let's go in the Christmas tree business. So it was called KC Farms. It's an old sign upstairs in the barn here. And then we had Christmas trees. I planted them and did the stuff, and he didn't do any of the work.
You didn't do any of the work. You did the work, and he got the money.
Well, by the time the trees were big enough to sell, he sold somebody else. And then Dr. Westmith bought the property.
Ah, okay.
And I continued on with the Christmas trees there.
When did you start your own Christmas tree farm?
Somewhere along the line, I don't know where it was exactly, because it was I probably didn't get going on my own until, holy smokes,
50s?
Oh, no, 60s.
Okay. And it's still
70s, 60s, somewhere in there. I don't know.
Early 70s.
Because I was in just a small lot. We're not wholesale. We're just retail.
Mm-hmm.
Come and cut your own stuff.
It's still going. You're still doing the trees.
We are. We plant. We sell about 125 trees a year. We plant 200 each year, and by the time we get around, some of them either get nipped off by a mower,
yep,
or they don't shape up right,
mm-hmm,
or they don't live to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So we can keep about the same size of inventory by replacing that.
Okay.
It's that rate.
And it's on your property?
Right here, in part of a hayfield, yeah.
Okay.
The stoniest part of the hayfield. We didn't want to have to, I didn't want to plow that part again.
Yeah, New England is known for their rocks.
We grow them.
Well, yes.
Yeah, they come up.
My father came from Vermont, and he had my mother convinced that you plant a pebble, it grows into a rock, and eventually it becomes a boulder.
Just about the way it works.
Do you remember anything about the 55 flood?
Well, I know that in 1955, when the flood came, and that week we had rainfall from Monday all the way through the end of the week, we bought this house that in September, October of that year, and the brook, we had gravity water feed for the house here, and the little brook that runs on the other side of this calf pen and calf hutch here jumped its bank and came down through the yard and went down cellar and so on. So I remember that. We didn't own it during the flood, but the cellar was then empty of water by the time we got here. But I was in the, at that time we were among, as a forester, with an education in forestry, people didn't know what a forester was, hardly, in 1955, or 54, or 53.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to, they thought a forester, somebody who maybe went to school and then sat in a fire tower out west.
Oh, no.
But there was more to it than that. But there weren't many consulting foresters or self-employed foresters in the whole USA at that point. So I was managed some woodlots and had lined up two or three clients, a water company and a fishing club and a few other things that had some land that appreciated what a forester could do, managing the land and getting them income and not hurting them. Mm-hmm. The woodlot. But I also like to work with my hands and my back and my arms and so on. So I also got into the, again, if I had a woodlot to buy or to sell for somebody, the trees to mark after dealing with the landowner and find out what his wishes, I would, if there were cedar trees in the understory of the pine forest, the cedar trees, the fact that the pine was there indicated it had been farmed before. Mm-hmm. And when you abandon a pasture or so on, one of the first things to come in hereabouts, or can well, if it's a seed source, would be red cedar.
Right.
And the red cedar came in first, and then the pine would come in a little bit later and overtop the cedar, and the cedar would finally get shaded out gradually. And if it got shaded, it was going for light all the time, going for light, and making more heartwood. And on red cedar, the heartwood, the red part, which is the inner growth and the cambium, and the outer growth is the sapwood, and there'd be more and more heartwood. So the good red cedar is a tree, but also the heartwood was big,
mm-hmm.
and it was in good shape and built right and tall and slender for tobacco poles. So I used to buy the cedar standing, and then had myself and a couple of guys, we cut the cedar down, skid it out with a tractor, bucket 12 feet long with a 4-inch top, load it on my truck that I had to buy an old Army vehicle, and take it up to the Connecticut Valley, up as far as Northampton or above Northampton, to tobacco farms to get a contract with them to supply them with cedar posts. So we did quite a lot of that.
Ah, now that I didn't know.
Well,
you used to come in, when I was teaching 6th grade botany, you would come in and you'd teach the kids about the different kinds of trees and how to identify them.
Oh, yeah.
And so we learned about heartwood and sapwood and cambium and yeah. understory and that yeah. sort of thing from you.
Oh.
So you were a teacher as well as all of these other things.
Oh, good.
It was good. The kids.
I'm glad somebody was listening.
The kids enjoyed being outside,
yeah.
listening to somebody else besides me,
yeah.
you know, and learning something that was practical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always a big event when you came to school.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm assuming the tobacco poles would be what they would hang the tobacco leaves on to dry?
Tobacco poles, they set them up, string wires between them, put cheesecloth on top of them with all shade-grown tobacco to assimilate the same sort of a climate you'd have in Sumatra.
Right.
And then they grew the tobacco underneath, harvested it from there, and then stored it in racks hanging in those big tobacco barns that you used to see throughout the Connecticut Valley.
This is all the Connecticut Valley.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there were...
Some in Massachusetts?
Still fairly well... On Lincoln City Road, where the Gray School is now, at one point, a guy grew tobacco there. And you go on Route 7, two or three miles before you get to New Milford, on the left-hand side, down near the Housatonic River, there's an old tobacco barn there. So, but they weren't growing shade-grown here. There was just tobacco for chewing tobacco or cigars or... whatever.
When I talked with you on the phone, you told me you knew the real name of Cock Robin.
Edward Melius. Ed Melius. He was born somewhere in New York State. And he named Cock Robin because he called square dances.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. That's fascinating.
And he worked as a laborer at Salisbury School when I was there, mowing lawns and rolling the tennis court and
mm-hmm.
doing this and that. Then after I came back up here, after the war and all, he was working up at Hotchkiss School and the golf course. George Quayle's uncle was George Millmine, who lived on the road to Hotchkiss School and had a barn on his land. And in the Owens oh, Cock Robin died November 20th, 1951. Cock Robin, George and I had a square dance, and we got the Garrity from Norfolk. He was a He Mr. Gary was a blacksmith, and his wife played the piano. And there was somebody who was a fiddler, and Ed Melius was Cock Robin, and he called the dance.
That's fun. I used to square dance. That's fun. I could do that because I could follow directions.
Yeah. And usually the kind of people that square dance and like it, they aren't so darn dead serious that you can, if you make a mistake, they'll...
Oh, everybody will laugh.
And you'll laugh.
Oh, yeah.
They'll
oh, yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are fun. Do you know why the Jigger Shop was called the Jigger Shop?
No, I don't. I remember the Jigger Shop, but I don't know why it was called the Jigger Shop.
Nobody knows. And I thought you would know.
No, I don't know.
Oh, dear. You've disappointed me.
Well, once again.
What was the neighborhood like here when you moved here? Were any of the businesses running, the grist mill or the Salisbury Artisans or any of that?
Salisbury Artisans was going. The grist mill was going when I was at Salisbury School in the 1930s. It was not going when the Cassandiques bought the mill from George Selleck. They bought the mill, we bought here in 55, they bought the mill in 53, I think, in the mill property.
Okay. And I've done David Bowen on Salisbury Artisans.
Okay, yeah.
As well as George Parsons and Barbara Rohrbeck.
Yeah.
On the Salisbury Artisans.
Okay,
so I think I got that one covered.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
How about the Whitbecks? Didn't they live somewhere around here? Sam Whitbeck?
The Whitbeck, a previous generation of Whitbeck, were the house in front of where David Bowen lives, that colonial house.
Yes.
It was John and Janet Swing lived there.
John and Janet who?
Swing.
Okay.
They lived there. But that was originally a Whitbeck. That was a Whitbeck house. And the Whitbecks, I think a lot of bloodline came from Mount Washington, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Because there were Whitbecks on Mount Washington in, how the heck was it now, 1680 or 1690, there were Whitbecks and Spurs.
Oh, yeah.
Spurs were the previous name of Spur.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlotte Reed was a...
She was a Spur.
She was a Spur.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that Spur family had a farm where Berkshire School is.
Oh.
Neither here nor there, but it is here and there.
But it gives a texture and a depth to the land and how it's changed.
It's all tied so much together.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's the fascinating part.
Yeah.
As I drive from Lakeville to Salisbury now, and I look at the houses, so-and-so built that for his daughter for a wedding present, or yeah. So-and-so built that for such-and-such, or this used to be, and I get such pleasure out of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I'm learning a little bit of the history.
Yeah.
And that's what I enjoy. Now, I know that you used to ski at Salisbury School. And Matt told me that the original ski swaps used to be here in the kitchen.
Was, yes.
When did you get involved in the SWASA at the beginning?
Well, it was in 1950. I guess it was. I guess I'm still working at Childs then, 50 or 51, when the hill was dedicated to John Satre. There was a ski jump that weekend, and ribbon cutting and so on, and I just heard they needed volunteers down there. They were chopping ice that came from, I don't know where the ice came from, but the chopper came from the Economy Ice Company in New Haven, Connecticut. They had an ice chopper, and that chopped ice and blew it on the hill, or blew it out, and then we had to rig up ways to get it on the landing, you know, and so on.
So you were using ice to begin with?
Yeah.
This isn't summer skiing. This was for the winter.
This is for the... Well, we had the summer skiing, but that was ice. But we also... We already used ice before that.
Oh, okay.
For winter skiing, but we didn't... We never seen summer skiing.
Okay.
So that was... Well, back in 50, 51, or whatever it was.
So you got involved really early.
Somehow, I guess they said, well, we'll keep him around. He knows how to work.
Yeah, well, you know, the good workers are hard to find.
But there's just a good association with the club, and met a lot of good friends and a lot of good people. And after a third of the people that come through this door to say hello to me are winter sports.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
I'm one of the exceptions. I am not a skier. But it's gone on, and it's expanded, and the town supports it thoroughly, which is a wonderful thing for something that has been going on this long.
Yeah. Well, we're real, at least.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
And institutions like that continue with town support are now rare.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful organization.
Yeah.
I'll bet you know about the farms on Salmon Kill River. What can you tell me about the Belter Farm?
Well, the Belter Farm was Rockydale Farm. Thinking about some couple of these things.
Oh, good.
The other day, and I wrote a note or two down.
Because I always ask for things you want to talk about when I get through.
Rockydale Farm, yeah.
Was it dairy?
Oh, yes, definitely. These are all dairy. When you say farms now, they're dairy farms.
Okay, and there were about 35 of them at one time.
Yeah.
And now we're down to what, two or three?
We're
something
down
like
to
that.
Nobody in Salisbury is making milk to sell.
No.
Nobody.
I did Tommy Payne yesterday on Grasslands Farm, and it's now cattle. It used to be dairy.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm learning.
Yeah.
Well, and
Whippoorwill Farm was where Alan Cockerline is, where Alan and Robin Cockerline are.
Yeah.
And that was miners.
Which miner, George?
Bob and Harold.
Now, Whippoorwill is vegetables and...
Grass-fed beef.
Beef.
Eggs and pork. Grass-fed beef, eggs, and pork.
Yeah, okay. All righty.
Let's see, who else? Any other... Those two farms are primarily it, right? Oh, no. Where Greenberg lives, that was called Overbrook Farm.
Now wait a minute, you're ahead of me. Greenberg?
Greenberg.
And that was over?
That was Overbrook Farm. That was a dairy farm. That was Overbrook Farm. It's Greenberg now. He bought from Tilt.
Okay.
Tilt bought from Peels.
Yep.
Peels bought from...
I think I've got that from Dan Dwyer.
Okay.
Because he rented property from Peel at one time.
He rented property from Till.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Because Till's wife's mother, his wife's sister, was in an iron lung and lived in the house where Dan Dwyer lived.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Smithers.
I knew you'd come up with it.
Smithers is one of in that chain. And before Smithers, I don't know for sure.
Well, that's far enough back.
All right.
Because I've done enough of these, I can sort of dovetail. If you don't remember, I think I've got it someplace else.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the beauty of doing this because my own self don't have the knowledge, but I've pulled it from other people.
Yeah.
For some of it I remember, some of it I don't.
You're picking a brain that's been pulled from everybody else.
Well, I now have got Swiss cheese, I know.
Yeah. A lot of it's falling out in the holes.
Oh, I don't know. You got more in the holes than other people have in the whole cheese. All right. You were selectman from about 84 to 88. You've been tree warden for about 23 years. You've always been in Salisbury Winter Sports Association. Are there other civic things over the years?
I was selectman for about 12 years altogether. I don't know.
Yeah, there was a gap in the middle.
Yeah. What else? When zoning first started, I was on that board.
Okay.
I was on the Board of Tax Review. And selectmen, Housatonic River Commission.
What's the Housatonic River Commission?
Housatonic River Commission.
Protecting the water?
Protecting the river. We are... from Massachusetts line to Boardman's Bridge, which is on the north of the village of New Milford, there are seven towns, and each town has two members on the Housatonic River Commission, and we are there to assist the zoning boards in each of those towns, and when anyone is going to build in the inner corridor, which is the floodplain and land next to the river, or within the outer corridor, which is from where the floodplain or the inner corridor ends to the ridge lines on either side of the river, any operations that go on in there in the way of building or clearing and so forth, we advise the Planning and Zoning Commissions and put a bit of our input in to make sure that a lot of erosion doesn't occur or whatever.
Or pollution. Okay.
Or whatever goes with it. Yeah.
All righty. Now we get to the good part. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you're covering it. I don't know. I'm good.
You're good?
Yeah.
Is there anything particular that you'd like to add?
Not really. I guess you know more about me than I do now.
Thank you so much for your time and your information.
Yeah.